Welcome to the Abridged Presidential Histories with Kenny Ryan, episode 16C, an interview on Lincoln and the media with Harold Holzer. I'm really excited to welcome Harold Holzer to the show today. Harold is the director of the Roosevelt House Public Policy Institute at Hunter College in New York City. He's the chairman of the Lincoln Forum and author of numerous books about Lincoln and the Civil War. His most recent book is titled The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media from the Founding Fathers to Fake News. Harold also recently appeared in the just out CNN docuseries, Lincoln, Divided We Stand. And now the political press has come up a few times in this podcast, but usually just in passing. You know, way back at the beginning, Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson created party newspapers to support the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. They were heavy in partisanship and light on facts and news, and that was pretty much the norm for the next 100+ years. It was something Lincoln definitely had to grapple with. When he won his election in 1860, the Southern Democratic press had so terrified Southerners with reports that Lincoln would free their slaves that the South seceded, helping cause the Civil War. And then during the Civil War, Lincoln had to learn how to master the press to keep Northern morale up and win support for his policies like emancipation. So I'm delighted to dive deeper into the history of the partisan press, how it made Lincoln's life more difficult, and how he learned to wield it to help him. Harold, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I didn't even have to say anything. You've summarized 45 years of my work right there. So you've done it in 2 minutes.
Well, as a fellow journalist, I always joke that's our superpower. We can get it really tight for you.
Right, right. You did, right? It's sort of sad that it's just one paragraph. That's
okay. Well, there's so much more to add. Let's put some meat on those bones. And okay. I'm really interested in this topic. As I mentioned before, I'm a former journalist, so this really intrigues me. What was the state of journalism in general on the eve of the Civil War?
As you say, it had continued along the path of extreme partisanship. And in Lincoln's case, as you've already elected him. So let's say he's elected president. He's not only grappling with Democratic Party newspapers in the North, which are arrayed against him and have been since he launched his career in Illinois. He had opposition from one of his hometown newspapers in Springfield, Illinois, the Democratic paper for his entire career, and praise from the Republican paper. Same thing in Chicago, same thing in Washington when he was a congressman in the 1840s to the degree that he got any attention at all. And then during the campaign, Democratic newspapers attacked him, Republican ones praised him. And add to that the fact that almost all Southern newspapers were anti-Lincoln. Well, I would say all Southern newspapers were anti-Lincoln, at least in the Deep South, to a degree. The Whig newspaper, the old Richmond Whig, was not a secessionist paper, but it was an anti-Lincoln paper. Interestingly, it's an interesting question. The only pro-Lincoln newspaper in the South was the St. Louis Missouri Democrat. The Missouri Republican was anti-Lincoln, but the Democrat was pro-Lincoln, and that's because they had acquired their names during the Jeffersonian era. So it was a little backwards. The Republicans were the Democrats. Anyway, it's all very confusing. But so he faced Democratic opposition and unified Southern opposition on the eve of the Civil War. And as you pointed out, a lot of agitation for the Southern states to leave the Union before he even did anything.
And I'm curious, was my kind of little hypothesis there that these newspapers had all been partisan through that first roughly 100 years of the country? Is that true? Had the country really just a partisan press, not much in the way of independent media?
So, the media was somewhat independent, that is, benign, not too probing, for the first 3 years of George Washington's first term. Then, as you pointed out, Thomas Jefferson thought it was unseemly for a democratic country, small d,
yeah,
to have no press opposition. So he got democratic because it's
sure
anti-federalist.
Yes.
Editor to relocate from New York to the new federal capital in Philadelphia and launch an anti-federalist newspaper. And Jefferson paid him a salary from the State Department to work as a translator, to add a little bit of incentive to the deal. And then Washington was astonished, shocked, depressed, angry. to note that he was criticized not only politically, but personally for the next 5 years of his presidency. I think it's one reason why he didn't run for a third term. He just had it. So yes, the parties aligned differently.
Totally.
But there was always an opposition press and a pro-administration press. And it was good business, you know, if you could if you could tolerate it philosophically, good to be aligned with the party in power, because you got government printing contracts. Your editors, at least beginning in the Jacksonian era, got to be White House advisors. And, you know, there was no congressional record then. The proceedings and minutes of the House and Senate were done by the political party in charge. So they got to give patronage to newspapers. So very much partisan, pro-Jefferson, anti-Jefferson, pro-Jackson, anti-Jackson. And then as the Republican Party comes in to being in about 1853 and 4 and 5, all the old Whig press, the anti-slavery, old Democratic press becomes Republican affiliated, and the Democrats are the other side. And that's how it would remain for the next 40 years.
I've been wondering that, like where the Republican press comes from, how mature it is when Lincoln is elected. Would you say it's pretty unified, or is anyone still in kind of transition or limbo, or did you have that strong Republican press at his back?
I would say very much a strong Republican press. It wasn't a venerable press. I mean, a lot of these guys came into being as editors in the 1850s, like the Chicago Tribune. They bought an old newspaper called the Chicago Tribune, made it the Press and Tribune, but they inherited a really dilapidated printing press, and they had to invest a lot of money in getting it up to speed. On the other side of the coin, you had a paper like the New York Tribune, which was founded, as was the New York Times 10 years later, as a Whig newspaper. And they transitioned to a Republican paper. They were both anti-slavery papers in New York, and they just became Republican papers when the party existed. And yeah, they made the switch to official capital R Republican papers very fast, because the party alignment, realignment happened really fast. All of a sudden, Abraham Lincoln woke up a longtime Whig, and there was no Whig party anymore.
Yeah. So news papers all over the country, you mentioned it's good business, you know, we can be by the government. How widespread is the reading of these newspapers? What are the news habits of Americans on the eve of Civil War, both for the folks in the cities, the folks in the countries, you know, was there a difference?
It was voracious everywhere. I mean, there was something like 10 dailies published in New York City, some commercial papers, but mostly political papers. And, you know, people walked around with their newspaper under their arm. And remember, there were big broadsheets in those days, much bigger than the broadsheets today.
Yeah.
And that was like an advertisement. It's like wearing a political button, which people don't do anymore. But I did when I was a kid. people wore their newspapers as emblems of their political affiliation. And even though in the West, people got the news later, you know, than they did in the East, it was new to them, right? When they opened the paper, it was new. And then they got their own regional papers. You know, I'm struck that I remember, you know, you said to me before we started taping that you're from Seattle. Remember, Abraham Lincoln might have become governor of Oregon Territory, right?
Yeah.
He'd never been president. He could have lived in Washington State, but his wife wouldn't let him go.
Thank goodness. So I posited another kind of thesis earlier, is that partly the Civil War happened because of that Southern Democratic press, that they were riling folks up. Was that an accurate statement? Like, how much responsibility or how influential was the Southern Democratic press in causing the Civil War?
Well, slavery caused the Civil War, but totally. In triggering the rebellion, I would say very important, but I would not separate press from politics. It was not just that these newspapers were pro, right? It's that they were really cogs in the same machine. The way lots of people think Fox News is part of the Trump enterprise right now.
Mm-hmm.
They've got Sean Hannity and they've got Others, well, Tucker, not so much. I mean, Tucker, but we won't even, I won't even, get into that. but Sean Hannity has appeared at Trump rallies. Jeanine Pirro has appeared at Trump rallies.
Yeah.
I think, you know, MSNBC is obviously pro Democratic, pro progressive, but I don't think they participate in actual party politics.
Yeah.
In the mid 19th century, I mean, Horace Greeley, who was the editor of the New York Tribune, pro-Republican.
Mm-hmm.
The same year Lincoln was serving as president-elect, Horace Greeley ran for the U.S. Senate from New York. He lost. Other newspaper men ran for office and ran newspapers at the same time. Two members of Lincoln's first cabinet had run newspapers, Gideon Welles from Connecticut and Simon Cameron from Pennsylvania. The Speaker of the House, incoming Speaker of the House, had run a newspaper. They're all interwoven. And, you know, when Lincoln became president, Republican editors not only cashed in with printing contracts, they got federal jobs. They were rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
German language newspapers, Republican, the editor of the Chicago Tribune became Postmaster General of Chicago, which was a very big patronage job.
Yeah.
The editor of the New York Independent, which had invited Lincoln to Cooper Union, got a big federal job, and on it went. There was a joke at the outset of the Civil War that the time was soon approaching when the New York Tribune would be unable to publish its morning editions because so many members of the city room had been appointed to diplomatic posts and had left the city and the country. So there was lots of reward. And it was, so it wasn't, to get back to the original question, which was a yes or no, as I recall. Yes, the newspapers definitely inflame people, but it was also a political operation as well as the newspapers.
So as Lincoln steps into office and he's contending with all this, you know, right, states are starting to secede, war is starting to break out. It's a very stressful few years. How does he do as somebody who's trying to orchestrate the press and get it to help him do his thing? How did he manage journalists as he became president?
Well, it wasn't always easy. Before, I don't want to forget the repressive part. So remind me if I forget the most draconian things he did.
I'm going to call that up in a second.
Right. But I mean, one way was suppression of criticism, but I'll give you two subtler ways. In 1861, Confederacy fired on Fort Sumter, and then Lincoln called for volunteers and a blockade, and then nothing much happened for a few months. It was until July, between April, May, June, just 3 months, nothing happened. So Secretary of State William Seward thought there was a leadership vacuum. Now, he was very, very close to the editor of the New York Times, Henry Raymond. Suddenly, Henry Raymond began publishing editorials called Wanted a Leader.
Oof.
Wanted a Policy. We actually have, we don't, but we have, it had, they have survived, copies that Lincoln clipped out and wrote on top villainous editorials.
Wow.
And kept them in his files. So one day, Henry Raymond comes down to Washington on whatever was substituting for Amtrak in those days. Today's the 50th anniversary of Amtrak, so it's a big deal. President Biden is going to, as we speak, he's going to Philadelphia tomorrow to stand in the Union Station. And
nice.
Yes, to celebrate Amtrak, which he famously used to take every night.
Totally,
to Wilmington. Anyway, Raymond goes down by train to Washington, sets up a city room in William Seward's parlor, because Seward is going to present Lincoln a letter outlining how Lincoln, if he doesn't want to do anything, should make Seward his de facto prime minister. Let Seward run the aggressive reaction to secession, because Lincoln ain't doing anything.
Wow.
So Raymond actually is like writing the big story. Seward named de facto prime minister. And Seward comes in with this memo, and Lincoln very smartly does not reply in writing. All we have surviving is the memo, but he sits Seward down and says, basically, if anyone is going to do anything, it's going to be me. It ain't going to be you. And the political shorthand is that Seward became a completely loyal, devoted Lincoln man after that. He realized that there was a smarter guy than he in charge. But here's this journalist, this famous editor, he's stuck in with no story, and he's not even near his newspaper. He had bad luck in the Civil War, Henry Redmond. So Lincoln was outsmarting the newspapers and when he was doing things like that. When Horace Greeley wrote an editorial in the summer of 1862 called The Prayer of 20 Million, pleading with Lincoln to issue an Emancipation Proclamation so that black troops could be recruited, Lincoln knew something that the readers didn't know, and that is that Greeley knew that Lincoln had already drafted a proclamation and was just waiting, and that Greeley wrote that editorial not to plead with him, but so that he could set himself up to get credit after it was issued. So what does Lincoln do? He writes a letter to the editor, I would call the most famous letter to the editor in American history, saying, what I do to save the Union. What I forbear about slavery, I forbear to save the Union. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to destroy or save slavery. If I could save the Union by freeing all of the slaves, I would do it. If I could save the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save the Union by freeing some and leaving others alone, which is what he was going to do, I would do that. And this, by the way, this letter has haunted Lincoln's reputation.
Yes, yes.
Because it makes him seem like he's an insincere emancipator, unless, and I always urge people to remember that he'd already written the Emancipation Proclamation. He was just waiting for a battlefield victory to issue it. So Lincoln writes this letter, and then rather than give it to Greeley, he gives it to a newspaper in Washington to publish it and scoop the Tribune.
Fantastic.
And he gives it to the paper to be published, to think how, just to think of how this guy knew how to work the press. He gave it to the newspaper on a Friday evening so that it could be published on a Saturday. Why? Because Greeley didn't publish a Sunday edition. So not only would he be scooped, he would be screwed. He'd have to wait 2 days to get the story that everybody else was writing on Saturday and Sunday. And
Greeley
really threw up his hands and said, "Your old Abe is too smart for me."
So,
and you know, and I would say one other way. I'm sorry to go so long.
No, but go for it. Yeah.
One other thing he did was other correspondence. The Greeley thing taught him a lesson. When I'm writing a letter to someone on a policy issue, I'll give it to a newspaper. So a number of letters, the Corning letter, which was written as a reply to a Democratic group in Albany, New York, justifying his suspension of civil liberties, that went to the press as well. A letter defending black recruitment later on went to a newspaper as well. We call them public letters now, but they were really like press releases.
Yeah.
In the day before there were press releases or press secretaries or press conferences. Too bad Lincoln wasn't the one who initiated press conferences, because he would have been great at it.
This I have so many questions coming from the stories you just shared. I'm going to try to remember and ask them all. One of the first ones that comes to mind is it sounds like Lincoln is very much like cat and mouse almost with these guys, is how he's managing them. When I think of more modern, say past 60 years presidents, like I think of JFK nurturing friendly relations with, you know, editors. Did Lincoln do any of that, or was it always arm's length cat and mouse?
Well, when he was a up and coming leader, the Chicago Tribune and the Springfield State Journal were his mouthpieces.
Got it.
I mean, he would go into the office of the Springfield paper and say, I know there's pressure on me to name a Southerner to my cabinet. This really happened. I'll write an editorial so that you can say, how could Lincoln appoint a Southerner? What if they disagree? Who yields, Lincoln or the Southerner? And they published it as their editorial. We have it in Lincoln's handwriting.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So it was like writing,
yeah,
you know, pushing policy through the press. So when he gets to Washington, you know, he has good, really good relationships with the editor, John Forney, who is in control of a major Washington paper. Lincoln gets him a cushy job as the chief presiding officer of the U.S. Senate. That's, you know, and after that, Forney is his. he makes another newspaper man the chief government printer. Not as lucrative as it used to be, because the printing office, the government printing office, begins in the Lincoln era. It was passed before but it starts in the Lincoln era. So yeah, he remained close, but he had tough relations with a lot of them. James Gordon Bennett of the New York Herald printed a stolen edition of his first State of the Union message. And Lincoln, you know, got really angry. So what did he do when he ran in 1864? This is a Democratic editor. He made a deal with this guy that he would not overtly support the Democratic presidential candidate, in return for which Lincoln would name this editor as ambassador to France. And wait, it gets better. Yeah. With the understanding that Bennett would refuse that appointment. He just wanted it to look good. They made that whole deal. But there were some who were impossible, like Horace Greeley. He remained a thorn in Lincoln's side throughout, until Lincoln just cut him off. He called him a rotten shoe. And you have to think, what does that mean? Well, Lincoln was a prairie boy, right?
Yeah.
And the story is that they wore shoes for a really long time, and they were laced, you know, throughout. And when the holes, you know, the laces pulled through the holes, the mother would put a new set of holes in the shoe so that they could keep wearing it. But if three sets of holes were run through, then the shoe was rotten because you couldn't put a string in it anymore. That's what Lincoln's definition of Horace Greeley.
Next time my shoes wear out, I'm just going to give that a shot. I'm just going to go very old school and give that a shot. So I'd love to dive a little more into how Lincoln's relationship with the press changed over the course of presidency. And it sounds like you mentioned one big one where he has this moment where he realizes by writing letters to the press, that's a great way to communicate with people. Are there any other significant ways that his relationship changes or the way he treats them changes?
Well, I'm going to assume you're queuing me up for the big issue, which is that first in April and then again in July, mm-hmm. there are two big waves in which the Lincoln administration and the army crack down on dissent in the press. And they do it in a really draconian way. The first wave is to stop the kind of inflammatory editorializing you talked about at the outset of the show in the states that had not yet seceded. So in Missouri, in Maryland, in Delaware, in Kentucky, the army closed, and when I say suppression, it means shutting down a newspaper and arresting editors.
Wow.
One Kentucky editor was sent to Fort Lafayette in Brooklyn Harbor in New York City. Well, it wasn't New York City, it was Brooklyn in those days, but a long way from home, until he was ready to sign a loyalty oath saying he would not criticize the Union. So they stopped Union agitation by closing down newspapers. Now that was, you know, Lincoln's justification was, I can't let Maryland secede. When a Baltimore editor wrote a pro-secession editorial, he was arrested and thrown into Fort McHenry in Baltimore Harbor. And I love to talk about his case because his name was Francis Key Howard. He was the grandson of Francis Scott Key.
Hey.
Who had seen the bombs bursting in air at Fort McHenry.
Yeah.
You know, 50 years before. And here he was now on the inside looking out. That repression was very tough. But after the Battle of Bull Run, which the Union loses in July, it coincides with the end of the first 90 to 100 day volunteer period for the Union Army, mm-hmm. which is all volunteer at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So a big push is made to get soldiers to re-enlist. But some Northern newspapers, Democratic papers, say, don't enlist. We lost the Battle of Bull Run. Let the South go. We don't need this war. We don't need this bloodshed. Suddenly, the Union Army, the State Department, the Interior Department are arresting editors in New York, throwing newspapers off trains, refusing to mail them to subscribers in the post office. And that continued throughout the Civil War. And I've counted something like 260 newspaper shutdowns during the Civil War. And Lincoln believed in it. He thought these people were spies and traitors, and he was not going to allow them to publish.
What a fascinating angle, Lincoln, that I hadn't discovered yet. What was kind of the reaction to this, both among Lincoln's peers, you know, among the people?
It was extraordinarily mild.
Yeah.
Some editors like Greeley and Henry Raymond wrote editorials saying there's no such thing as free press during a civil war. And indeed, that was Lincoln's argument that Article 2 of the Constitution says that the writ of habeas corpus may be suspended in times of war. It also, the Second Amendment, well, the First Amendment says, you know, freedom of the Congress can't pass any laws that abridge freedom of the press. Lincoln didn't ask Congress. He did it by executive order or through the army.
That's sneaky.
And he only signed one personal order closing down a newspaper, but he was acquiescent to all of it. And I was astonished when I wrote an earlier book called Lincoln and the Power of the Press, how little blowback there was. There was blowback during political campaigns, the congressional election of 62 and the presidential election of 64. Once Lincoln decided, and this is to his immense credit as a small D Democrat, once he decided that elections could go forward and indeed had to go forward, otherwise the government could, you know, the South could say that the North was ruined.
Yeah.
Those periods he allowed any kind of dissent, craziness, personal vilification. It was like it was a holy day period. And Lincoln tolerated any kind of abuse. Sometimes he responded. Usually he didn't. Sometimes he drafted a protest. They didn't send it.
Yeah.
But then as soon as it was over, he went back, even after the election of 1864. Now, interestingly, he had personally shut down two New York papers in June of 64.
Yeah.
For printing a false proclamation. But by September, once the campaign really got underway,
yeah,
because the Democrat wasn't nominated until August 31st,
yeah,
then he let these same papers attack him without protest.
Wow. In what ways did Lincoln's approach to the press, all these different approaches, the crackdowns, the coddling, the cat and mouse games, in what way did this all help him maintain Northern support for the war and win the war?
Well, it very nearly didn't. I mean, he decided to let Democratic newspapers promote Democratic candidacies and Republican conspiracy theories throughout the campaign. Now, he won by 54-46% in 1864, but none of the Southern states voted.
You're right. Yeah.
So, you know, he really got about the same number of votes through which he had squeaked by in 1860.
Yeah.
So, you know, he played a good game. He, his descendant Republicans.
Yeah.
Who are arguing that D.C. statehood is a purely political maneuver to get extra electoral votes. Do these Republicans know that in 1864, Lincoln pushed for Nevada to be admitted to the Union as a guaranteed 3 extra electoral votes for him? Because he thought that it was going to be even electorally. He wrote 2 different versions of a handwritten chart, almost like doodling when he was in the telegraph office waiting for war news. He was just playing with different. Do you remember the famous Tim Russert? You're probably too young. In 2000, he held up a piece of oak tag, which is now in the Library of Congress, calculating what happens if Florida does this and Delaware does this, and you know, to get to 270, whatever it is. And he was writing furiously. Lincoln did the same thing in 1864. And both times he did it, he was only like winning by one state. So he was very concerned that it was going to be a very close election. Look, one thing he did, and a friend of mine did a lot of research on this, is he made sure soldiers voted.
Yeah, yeah.
In the field. It was the first time it happened. And then he made sure that they only got Republican newspapers to give them news. Now, it was not, you know, he thought that the soldiers' vote would tip things. It really didn't. They, you know, but it could have. Mm-hmm. So he was around the edges, certainly fighting.
So we're recording this a night after Joe Biden's first speech to a joint session of Congress. And that got me thinking earlier Back then, you know, presidents didn't deliver State of the Union addresses in Congress or anything, but right. they did deliver inaugural addresses, and Lincoln's are pretty famous. How important are inaugural addresses as media moments and opportunities to set the narrative?
Could I answer a question you didn't ask first?
Yeah, sure, of course.
So his first, he did deliver messages to Congress, meaning somebody delivered the yes. manuscripts and they yeah. were read by clerks. Probably in the most desultory manner. And Lincoln wrote some beautiful, beautiful messages yes. to joint session. And right after he was inaugurated, and I will get back to it, his first message to Congress was on July 4th, 1861. It was a special message to Congress. And it said, this is a people's contest to, you know, decide whether people had equal opportunity, a fair chance in the race of life. It was a great, great, a little disjointed, but a great message. And he was telling the story also in a different section about mm-hmm. how this rebellion took root, this idea of rebellion took root in Southern hearts. And it said that he blamed it on the aristocracy for feeding a line to the people that their liberties were at stake. And he wrote, with the rebellion thus sugarcoated, the whole region was became disloyal. So one, a newspaper man who was going to have this reprinted came to him and said, Mr. President, not to criticize you, but you've used this expression sugarcoated. And I don't think it's dignified enough to be in the state paper. And Lincoln said to him, I will never avoid a word that the plain people, a phrase that the plain people of this country understand. So sugarcoated stayed. Just a little note on special messages. But inaugurals were huge, as big then as now. I mean, there was no live TV and there was no internet.
I know, it's occurring to me now, you made the point that State of the Unions were by paper. And I'm like, oh yeah, there weren't pictures back then. Like either one, it's equivalent as far as
there were pictures of the inaugural. And Lincoln, the first inaugural was photographed, but you couldn't see anybody because it was so right. far back.
Yeah.
Somehow the second inaugural, Alexander Gardner, a Washington photographer, took a viewable photographs of Lincoln seated on stage waiting mm-hmm. and then delivering. There are photographs of him delivering his second inaugural address, holding the paper.
Yeah.
Daniel Day Lewis didn't hold the paper, but Lincoln actually did hold the paper. He always liked to read. He never liked to ad lib.
Yeah.
And in fact, he'd had a newspaper print up the speech and then he cut it out so he could do big line separation.
Ah.
He pasted. He loved to cut and paste, which is strange for a president to do. I mean, FDR collected stamps, Lincoln cut out clips and pasted. Yeah. He even pasted part of his Emancipation Proclamation. But they were huge moments. And I think both speeches are quite brilliant. I think the first inaugural is not always regarded as a masterpiece because the second inaugural is such a masterpiece. And by the way, talking about the press, how were they received? The Democratic press hated both speeches and the Republican press loved both speeches.
Yeah, I think I saw a Democrat press take on the Gettysburg Address. Like, nobody's ever going to talk about this thing again, you know.
Well, in fact, somebody said the silly, flat, dishwatery remarks of the man who has to be pointed out to intelligent people as the president of the United States. That was
that
a British.
That is some writing.
That was a British paper.
A British paper. Respect to the British for their use of language there.
Right. Yes, it was good.
So did Lincoln have any lasting impact on the relationship between the presidency and the press? Is there anything that you look at how presidents and press interacted that you can say before it was different, after it was new in this way?
Well, presidents writing directly for the press or indirectly/directly for the press was a phenomenon that would continue. Presidents would release things to the press that had never happened before.
Oh.
They, you know, in the old days, and Jackson, the last two-term president, the last twice elected president, they would issue documents and the newspapers would print them. But to give things directly to the press was unheard of before Lincoln. Now, of course, we have, you know, daily briefings and tweets, not as many as we used to have, but we had tweets. I'll tell you, Lincoln also made it safe for presidents to crack down on the press without being perceived as tyrants. Wilson shut down newspapers and controlled the flow of information during World War I. FDR did so during World War II. Both presidents also learned from Lincoln and then some in conducting major pro-war war propaganda efforts. Wilson on radio and FDR in the movies, and you know, Wilson had speakers bureaus and all sorts of pro-war activities, not just suppression. And you know, John Kennedy fought against disclosure during the Cuban Missile Crisis and argued about accessibility by the press. And when I began writing The Presidents and the Press in the midway in the Trump era, the press had, of course, you know, reacted to the insults, if nothing else, from Donald Trump. But to go back to some of their previously written statements, it was clear that they regarded Barack Obama as the most repressive president in their memory because of extensive wiretapping and against reporters and their families to try to stop leaks in the White House.
Wow. I got two more questions for you, and they both look beyond Lincoln.
Okay. I'm trying to hang on to my voice, so I'll do my best.
You're doing great. You're doing good. I appreciate it. The first one, and it's one I've been asking myself a lot the past few years, and that is, when and how did the United States escape the partisan press? When did a golden age, you know, these values of objectivity and journalism, when does that take over?
So I give credit to Adolf Ochs, who is an immigrant trying to make it in the newspaper business, and he buys the Chattanooga Times and decides on a new ethos of journalism. Let's stay away from politics and talk about municipal improvement. And then in 1897-8, he buys the New York Times. Henry Raymond dies in the late 1860s, and the newspaper starts a slow downward cycle, but is still a Republican paper. When Ochs buys it, it's the new thing of all the news that's fit to print, which is still on the masthead, and that great Gothic print that's still on the masthead. He makes it, well, actually give Raymond some credit for that logo, but Ochs transformed the newspaper and created a new alternative. But similar credit from a totally different approach goes to Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst, because they invented something that was even more prevalent than a political journalism, and that was yellow journalism and big headline journalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Lincoln was the perfect man for the partisan press. He either mastered them or he cracked down on them. Teddy Roosevelt in 1901 is the perfect man for the headline-oriented press because he's like a nuclear plant filled with news. And he loves to leak and draw balloons and get headlines. And he does, you know, he crowds out other people's stories with his own scoops. He was a master at that genre. He's the right man at the right time. So a combination of yellow journalism and objective journalism, but it's really not till 1900 that it dies out. There's still editorial criticism. The Chicago Tribune always hated Democrats. They were pro-Republican. It just, you know, they extended their hatred to FDR, and who never won a majority editorial endorsement in any of his four elections, by the way.
Huh, interesting.
And then the development of new media makes, you know, newspapers go searching for a niche.
Yeah, totally. And my last question I have for you, speaking of new media, we seem to be falling back into another age of partisan press, you know, right, between online echo chambers, internet search algorithms, Fox News, talk radio. How similar is today to the eve of the Civil War in terms of the extremely partisan press and how dangerous it's getting? If you think it's getting dangerous.
Well, I will concede that the similarities are really clear. And print is now following. To be successful now as a print enterprise or a platform. The owner of the New York Times once said to me, "We're not a newspaper, we're a platform." Mm. I said, "Okay, whatever that is." Now I know. Then I didn't know. These print enterprises are now finding partisan niches. I mean, you can argue that the Washington Post and New York Times are kind of daily or really 24-hour progressive feature platforms. You know, they make their own news. They don't even necessarily cover news, although, you know, obviously a State of the Union or presidential message they cover, but it's a lot of analysis, a lot of investigative reporting. But yeah, I would say the cable algorithm is very close to where we were before the Civil War. And the viewers are just as segregated into silos as they were. And the danger now is that people who watch Fox don't watch MSNBC. Mm-hmm. And people who watch MSNBC don't watch Fox. So mm-hmm. they don't know what other arguments are. And also the arguments themselves are getting shriller on both sides of the spectrum. Do I think it's dangerous? Yeah, I think it was dangerous. Look at January 6th. That was dangerous. An insurrection is a danger point. But I'm willing to be, or eager to be, as positive as President Biden was in his first message to Congress when he said, "We had a crisis, but we overcame it. We're okay now." We'll see. But I think the way to overcome pot-stirring, agitation-generating journalism is, you know, slow but steady recovery from the pandemic and achievements and maybe mitigating racial inequality, not arguing about whether we're a racist country or not, but actually doing something to improve equal application of justice and make policing more about protection than about killing people. I think we have if we continue to make progress, I think it's going to tone things down.
Thank you so much for your time, Harold. I really enjoyed having you on the show.
Well, let's do it again. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks. If you'd like to hear more from Harold, he has a number of books out there you can read, including The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. And it's totally going on my reading list. Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
Thanks, Kenny.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Abridged Presidential Histories. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, tell your friends about the show, and leave a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform of choice. It's always good to hear from you. You can also follow the show on Facebook at Abridged Presidential Histories or on Twitter at APH Podcast. If you'd like to support the show, you can look it up on Patreon or go directly to www.patreon.com/abridgedpresidentialhistories. It helps me buy books and pay to host the show, and thank you to everyone who has contributed so far. The music in today's podcast is a public domain recording of the United States Army Olgar Fife and Drum Corps. In our next episode, I'll talk to historian Brian Dirk about how Lincoln's law career prepared him for the legal landmines he faced presiding over the Civil War and Emancipation. That's next time on Abridged Presidential Histories.